As you heard from my testimony, my son Daniel is 3 years old. And one of the favorite things for a three-year-old is to help. Daniel loves helping. I'm not very good around the house. B&Q is not the store I need to be going into. It's rather dangerous for me to go there. Whenever Lupita wants something done, she waits until it's completely necessary before she lets me at it. But whenever I get her to job, Daniel runs alongside with his little plastic tool set. And he said, Daniel will help. And Daniel's favorite toy in his plastic tool set is the little blue hammer. And Daniel's way of helping is to hit everything with the hammer as hard as he can. And it makes me smile. It helps me remember back to when I was really young and things that I had forgotten. One of my earliest childhood memories is helping my dad in the first house that he had bought together with my mum. It was a house in Ballinahinch. It was cheap for a reason. It was a house that needed serious remodeling. And Dad is quite the opposite from me in many ways. He is an architect and is very good with his hands, and Mum trusted him to do major renovations. So I remember when I was about 4 years old, Dad walking into what was a living room and a dining room with a sledgehammer. And he had covered things in plastic, and I had a little wooden tool set. They made them out of wood rather than plastic back then. You go figure that out. But I walked in with my little wooden hammer, and I said, I'll help. So Dad started at one end of the wall that was going to be knocked down, and I started at the other end. And we didn't meet in the middle. Dad worked his way towards my end, and the wall was demolished, and what was a living room and a dining room in an old-style house became what we now call open-plan living back in the 70s. The one thing I remember when I was four is that everything was covered in dust. And for a four-year-old, that is great. The more mess, the better. Dad was covered in dust. I was covered in dust. Even though everything had been covered in plastic, the dust had got underneath. The whole place was a mess. As soon as that rubble hit the ground, the dust ball went up. And that reminds me a little bit. It helps me visualize what it must have been like to see the people of Israel outside the walls of Jericho. As those walls hit the ground, tall and thick, invincible they seemed, but they came crashing down with an almighty thud. And as soon as those stones, those rocks that had once protected, hit the ground, a dust ball would have risen up. The people of Israel would have been sweating from walking round those walls time and time again, so that dust would have just stuck to the people. They were covered in it. The dust of obedience. The dust of victory. What had seemed invincible as they listened to God's voice and did His will in His way, in His timing. The walls had come crashing down and they were covered in a dust which testified to the power, the grace, and the promises of God. They were right in the middle of God's will, His timing, His way, and they were a dust-covered nation. That is where I want to be. In the middle of His will, having Him working in and through my life to be a people covered in dust. You see, today as we look around, we are in a world that is full of challenges. We are in a world where a spiritual battle is raging. It is raging for the hearts and the minds of our children and our grandchildren. Like no other generation before them, they are being pulled in multifarious directions, and the devil is trying to grab their hearts and their minds and their attention right from infancy, and to move them in a direction which is not of Christ. And the devil has taken control of the hearts and the minds, not only of people and societies, but of whole nations. And he has taken what has not belonged to him and which does not belong to him. And he has perverted hearts and perverted minds, and he is in control of areas where he should not be. There is a battle raging, and it's a challenge. But as you and I, as the people of God and the Church of Jesus Christ, take those challenges and we place them into God's hands and we put them before his throne, those challenges become opportunities. Opportunity to see his power, to see his grace, to see his mercy. Opportunity to see the thick, invincible walls crash. An opportunity to be a people covered in dust. You see, we see Joshua in this passage with four central things happening to him. And four things that we can learn from. And maybe only one of those things, the last of them, is what we would consider normal ministry or service. But the first three are foundational to see those walls coming crashing down. I want to take just a couple of minutes this morning as we look at those four things and to see how we as the Church of Jesus Christ can be a dust-covered nation. A testimony to God's power, God's mercy, working not only in us, but through us, as we, as a submitted people, are in the center of his will, doing what he says, when he says it, and how he wants it done, being reflected in our actions and in our lives. In verse 13, Joshua looks up. In verse 14, he falls right back down. In verse 15, he's told to take off his sandals or his shoes. And in chapter 6, verse 5, he stands with the rest of the people of Israel and shouts at the top of his lungs. Look up, fall down, take off your shoes, stand and shout. As Joshua's walking along, he's a military commander. It's a very normal thing. There's a siege going on. He's at Gilgal, which is about 2 miles northeast of Jericho. And he's probably preparing for the long haul. A siege is normally a long, drawn-out process. Nobody's going in, nobody's going out, etc. So he's going to survey the scene as the military commander. And as he's walking along, he looks up. And he sees a man. Now, most commentaries believe from the original text that this is an apparition of the pre-incarnate Christ. And I would probably agree that this is probably Christ preparing here as, or appearing here as, the commander of the army. So he looks up and he sees the man, or Christ, with the drawn sword. And as a military commander, he asks what I think is a very reasonable question. I would have asked the same question. Whose side are you on? Now, there could be two answers to that. I'm on your side. And if that's the answer, the man with the drawn sword's in serious problems. Because Joshua's commanded everybody to be at camp. So why are you here? If you're on my side, you should be obeying orders. You should be back at camp. You and I have got an issue. But if he's for the enemy, there's an even more serious problem, because Joshua's going to have to draw his sword, and there's going to be a fight before the fight. So Joshua asks what's a very reasonable question, and it turns out to be the wrong question. And we know that from the answer that is given. Whose side are you on? Joshua, I'm not on anybody's side. You've got it all wrong. I'm not on anybody's side. I'm in charge. You're not in charge, Joshua. You think you're the general. You think you're the person who makes the decisions and gives the orders. I'm in charge here, and I've come to let you know that you're part of my army, not vice versa. Whose side are you on? Is not the question, Joshua. And then Joshua's question, his whole paradigm changes, and we'll get on to that in a minute. But let's not miss the fact that Joshua looks up. Because that looking up, that seeing the man with the drawn sword, that changes the rest of the story. It changes the whole paradigm. It changes what is said, it changes what is done, and it changes the outcome. Joshua becomes a different person. What does it mean to look up? It means to fix our gaze, our eyes, but also our hearts on the person and the heart of Jesus. You see, brothers and sisters, there's so much going on. There's so much stuff in our day-to-day lives. It's possible to live our lives day after day without looking up and only looking around and to think we've got the picture, when we've really missed what's central. We have got to take time each and every day and during each and every day to ensure that we also look up, that our gaze is fixed on the eyes, the person, the heart of Christ, because that is transformational. See, when we look up and we gaze on the person of Christ, we fall in love. We fall in love deeper and deeper because we look at His heart and we look at His face and we see His mercy and His grace and His love for us. We begin to scratch on the surface of knowing Him. And that's a love affair which deepens and continues our whole lives. And as we fall in love with Him, we get to know Him better. And as we know Him better, we begin to see the world not through our misguided eyes, but we see the world through His eyes, and we see it the way it really is for the first time. And you know what? We see that it's not okay. And our hearts are broken and they're moved to a compassion that compels action. So as we gaze on the person of Christ, our knowledge of Him is deepened as we fall in love, and our understanding of the world becomes real for the first time as we see its misguided direction, as we see its need, and as our hearts are broken in compassion, as Christ's heart was broken, and He was moved to tears as He approached Jerusalem. So we become, as our world paradigm changes, as we see a world through His eyes. And we don't only see the world through His eyes as we get to know Him better, as we gaze on Him and look up, we see ourselves differently. We see ourselves, and we can no longer believe the lies of the devil. But we see ourselves as Christ sees us. Wondrously made, crafted in the hands of God, created individually and created for a purpose, a divine purpose, that nobody else can fulfill, because He has specially brought and commissioned us and created us with His loving hands to do that. We see that we are gifted by God, called by God, commissioned by God. We see ourselves as fallen. And we see and we smell the stench of sin and its destruction. We see Christ and we fall in love as we look up. We see the world and we understand its needs as He sees it. And we see ourselves created to meet those needs in response to His call. Our deep need for forgiveness and restoration and empowerment through His indwelling in us so that He can work through us. And as we put all of that together, we, like Joshua, fall down. as we see Him and we see the world and we see ourselves, we are filled with wonder at how He loves us and what He has done for us. And we fall down. As Joshua looks up and he hears the answer to the question, whose side are you on? I'm not on your side, Joshua. I'm in control. I'm in charge. I am the commander. He falls down. And his question changes, doesn't it? What would my master have his servant do? What a change in question. And it's the right question. What would my master have his servant do? He falls down in reverence. He falls down in worship. And you know, for me, one of the central areas of worship is my declaration to Jesus that I am listening. Speak, Lord, because your servant heareth. One of the central components of worship is my heart being in tune with Him. Me saying to Him that I love Him, that I trust Him, that I adore Him, and that my heart is surrendered to Him, and that I am listening so that when He speaks, I will understand. That is my heart in worship. So He falls down, and the question changes. What do you want me to do? His heart is submitted. You see, when we fall down in worship, when we fall down in reverence, we are saying, I am listening. And it presupposes a circumcised heart. We can't fall down in worship. We can't see the person of Christ, ourselves and the world, without saying, I surrender to you. It's a bit like what Paul went through, isn't it? We see Paul as a Christian and he goes through this struggle in the book of Romans. We get the culmination of that, I believe, in Romans 7. And you all remember that key verse where Paul's just basically getting fed up with himself. And he says, who will free me from this body of death, this body of sin? The things I don't want to do, those I'm doing. And vice versa. And he's basically saying, I am sick of this. I trust Jesus. I love Jesus. So I don't want to behave like I did before. And there's this struggle going into my heart as a believer. And I don't want to be like that anymore. I want to be different. I want to be victorious. And that's true for so many of us, isn't it? That as we look at the person of Christ and as we worship Him, we want to please Him. We want to live in a life of obedience to Him. And yet we find that our lives as Christians so often go, as Paul experienced, up and down. We find that we lose our temper. And we know we don't want to do it anymore. And it makes us annoyed. And we go to Christ and we say, Lord, forgive me. And we live in victory for one or two or three days, and then we find that we lose our temper again, and we go to Jesus. If your experience is the same as mine, I'm sure it is, and we go back and we say, Lord, how can you forgive me for the same thing again and again? Forgive me just this one more time. So we fall down and worship. We fall down with a surrendered heart. And Paul clamors out, who will free me from this body of sin? This body of death? And that's a very graphic image which Paul's using in Romans 7:24. The body of death was a capital punishment for murder in Roman times. It was called the body of death. And it was reserved for people who had committed murder. And what they did was, they took the perpetrator and they actually tied the victim to the perpetrator. So the corpse was tied to the perpetrator and was allowed to rot and decompose as the perpetrator died with the corpse tied to him. It was a slow, horrible death with the stench of one's victim right next to you. So Paul's basically saying, who will free me from this old Paul? The person that disgusts me. The person that I no longer want to be, but I feel as if I'm tied to. And he declares, Jesus. And Paul testifies later that he no longer lives, but that Christ lives in him. He has responded to Jesus' own call. If any man is going to follow me, he must take up his cross. He must die to self and then follow. A heart devoid of self. Paul said, I am crucified with Christ. Paul died to self. As we look up, we fall down, and that falling down requires us to say, Lord, I die to who I am. My vision, my desires, my thoughts and aims for the future, the things that I hold dear, I die to those. I am crucified with you. I don't leave them to one side. I want them nailed to the cross. I no longer live. And those areas of my heart that were occupied by self, my desires, my vision, my ideas, as they're nailed to the cross and I empty my heart of self, my Holy Spirit, fill those areas with your presence. Fill every single area of my life. Until your Holy Spirit not only fills my heart, but is overflowing in every area of my body, so that the fruits of the Spirit become evident not only to me, but those around me. And we too, with Paul, can say, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. Look up to fall down. The answer to the question, the right question, what would my master have his servant do? The answer was an unexpected one for Joshua. Joshua was a military man, as we've said. He was probably expecting a military command. I would have been. The man with the drawn sword said, I am the commander of the army. So he was probably expecting, as I would have expected, as you would have expected, build X amount of siege engines. Place a few thousand troops here and a few thousand there and do this, that, and the other. But all military related commands. They were in a battle. And he's told to take off his shoes. Isn't that wonderful? Completely unexpected. The right question, unexpected answer. Joshua, take off your shoes. What does that tell us? It's a call to intimacy, isn't it? Joshua, you and I have got to talk. You and I have got to spend time together. The battle will come. The battle is won. But as you fall down in worship, don't rush in. You know, many times as we place our hearts before the Lord, and we allow the Lord to speak to us, and we hear His voice, and we know His will. How many times have we rushed in and done His will in our timing and in our way? And we've messed it up. Take off your shoes. Joshua, come in to intimacy with me. Come in to dialogue. Come in to listen. And it's interesting that as he takes off his shoes and he comes into that intimacy which the broken heart and surrendered self allows and facilitates and opens up, it is then that God shares his plan He knows that it's God's will that Jericho be taken, but he doesn't know the how and the when. When he takes off his shoes, he gets it. Joshua, here's what's going to happen. Here's how it's going to happen. Here's your part, and here's what you've got to do. And you will be covered in dust. You've got to march, Joshua. It's not the command that he was thinking. We are called to take off our shoes. In our busy day-to-day lives, you're just the same as me. You probably do something similar to me. I have a to-do list. And I write it out at the start of the week. Maybe about 10 or 15 or 20 things on it, depending how bad the week is. And each day I'll tick things off. And at the end of the week, there's normally more things on the to-do list that have been left undone than done. So those get transferred to next week's to-do list. And the other stuff is added in. And it gets transferred and transferred and transferred until some of those things become irrelevant. And they get moved from the list altogether. We always seem to have more things to do than time to do it. And yet it's only coming into God's presence to listen to His voice as He indicates to us what His priorities are, and as they become our priorities, that we are able to focus on what really needs done, and God gives us the time to get those things done. And we find that His way is indeed easy, and His burden is light, because He leads the way, and He carries the burden. Let us not only look up and fix our gaze on Christ, let us not only surrender our hearts and invite Him to be everything in us and through us as we fall down in worship and listen to Him. Let us also respond to His call that comes with that heart, a call to intimacy, as He reveals not only His plan, but His very heart, the how and the when, which enables us to respond in obedience with that surrendered heart and to be where He has placed us, in the middle of His will, to be in the place of dust. Joshua is called to intimacy. Take off your shoes. He's also called to stand and shout. As he hears the plan, he understands what he is to do, when and how. And he gathers the rest of the people, and as a leader, he is able not to share his plan or his vision, but to share the heart of God. You see, the plan is very different from the one Joshua would have come up with. What a leadership lesson. Joshua could have spent a year in strategic planning meetings. He could have spent 3 years in committee meetings. And he would have never come up with the walking round the wall and shouting answer. He would have come up with a siege engine answer. And it wasn't the plan of God. He came into God's presence, he listened, and he shared God's plan with the people, and that's what they did. And the wonderful thing here is that Joshua was part of the plan, but he wasn't the plan. The people were the plan. And that's the same with us today. God has called us individually, and he's called us as the church of Jesus Christ. You see, when those people stood up, it was the whole people that stood. And as they stood up tall, every single member of the people of Israel held their head up high. Each person had a different voice. Some were louder than others. Some were softer. They had a different tone, a different inclination. When all those different voices came together, they came together in a holy crescendo that was deafening. And as those voices came together in obedience, love and submission, the walls came down. And the dust came up. And each and every one of them, not just Joshua, was covered in dust. The dust of victory, the dust of obedience. God's name glorified. An obedient people with a circumcised heart. Let us be that people. That church of God called into today's battle to be a people of dust. To stand and to shout. To do His will in His way, in His timing. As we draw all of that together, God's message to our hearts today as His church is very simple. We are in the middle of a battle. And we have an opportunity as the church that the church has never had before. As I look around the world today, there is no reason why the Great Commission cannot be fulfilled in our generation. There are over 1 billion people today that testify to being evangelical Christians. The world has 7 billion people in it. It's not a huge, insurmountable task in one generation that 1 billion people share Jesus with another 6 billion people. It's one Christian sharing with 6 non-Christians in their lifetime. Let us not see the Great Commission as something to be done by a future generation of the church. The command is now, and it's tangible. It's possible. It's our commission. The church has the resources to do it. Not only the people, but the financial resources. Modern technology expedites the process. We have that call. We have that opportunity, but an opportunity is also a responsibility. As we live our day-to-day lives, this week, next week, in the month to come, let us, as we walk along, look up. Let us have our paradigm transformed. Let us know Him better, see the world through His eyes, and understand our part in His plan. Let us fall down in final and complete submission to Him. Die to self as our act of worship. Let us respond to His call to intimacy. Let us take off our shoes so that we can listen to His voice. Understand His plan. Understand His timing. And be in the place where we are covered in dust. Let us, like Samuel, say, "Speak, because your servant is now listening." And let us today, this week, stand up individually and together as a family united in Christ. And let us shout each and every day, just that little bit wider. Let us become covered in dust for His glory.